Drones have become a key component of U.S. military operations all over the world, most notably in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, and Yemen. But a number of critics question their efficacy and the growing use of them on the battlefield and off the battlefield. Daniel Swift explores the nature of aerial warfare, both manned and pilotless, in his article, Conjectural Damage, A History of Bombing, which appears in the November issues of Harper's Magazine. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show today for our backstory segment. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Doesn't the idea of drone warfare, or at least robotically controlled planes, go all the way back to the First World War?
It does, indeed. And that was one of the things I was interested in writing about, was the continuity of this idea. I think so much of the way in which the press have covered the use of drones recently has been involved with an idea about newness, about the kind of the attraction of these drones is that they present this new technological answer to a very old problem, which is the problem of, you know, the man-made problem of warfare. And what I wanted to argue instead was that drones have been around for a very long time, that the first unmanned planes were developed in, you know, the years shortly before the First World War. So, yeah, we've been using unmanned weapons for a very long time.
But did they present problems? Is that why they have never really become, have never been employed in the way they are now, where we can do them through computers?
The early ones certainly presented problems, and there are kind of comic stories that that crop up in the history of unmanned flight. One of my favorites is in 1944, in fact, in reaction to the Germans sending the V-1 buzz bombs to London. The American and British Air Forces developed a program called Project Aphrodite, in which they took old, kind of worn-out B-17 bombers and filled them with TNT and then hoped to steer them by remote control to Germany and then bomb the places that the V-1 bombs were coming from.
They were just going to crash the planes?
Exactly, they were going to crash the planes. The trouble was that during the trial stage, they were testing these in England, of course, because they couldn't test them anywhere else. One of the planes escaped and headed off in the direction of Ipswich, which is a small city in England. So they were terrified that they were going to, by mistake, bomb Ipswich, and they canceled the project after that.
Why do we call them drones?
We call them drones, again, this is another quirky thing I discovered in reading about this peculiar history, because I think many people now think we call them drones because of the noise they make. And in fact, what I found was that in the early 1930s, the American Air Force experimented with a very early unmanned plane that they called the Queen Bee. It was, in fact, a Tiger Moth that was modified to make it unmanned. But so that's why they're all called drones now, as drones are the bees which follow the original Queen.
Well, kids play with remote-controlled planes often in our parks. Are they similar to what we were seeing in the 30s and 40s?
Yes, a very sort of humble, very naive version of those same technologies. The technology, of course, has hugely changed. What interests me is the thing that hasn't changed is the ideas and the fantasies about what we can do with drones, about what they're for. You know, obviously now, the sorts of weaponry we have, the sorts of unmanned planes we have are extraordinary compared to the ones we had even 10, 15 years ago. But the ideas remain very constant.
Well, I don't know if you follow American television, but the last show on The Good Wife involved somebody who had pushed the button too soon, and as a result, there were a number of civilians killed in Afghanistan who shouldn't have been killed. And I would assume that that's one of the big changes today, that we can control these things up to the last second. In the past, you'd send out the drone and hope that you didn't have a problem.
That's certainly true. And there has been an enormous development in the precision of the kind of controls and targeting of these weapons, certainly compared to the Second World War, the Vietnam War. And those bombing campaigns were very messy indeed. My worry is that, in fact, we believe too much in this kind of precision. And in fact, what the Predator and Reaper drones are doing in Afghanistan and Pakistan is not very precise. You know, we don't have the exact figures for the numbers of people killed in any of these strikes, but it seems likely that something like 2,000 people in Pakistan have been killed in drone strikes, which is a very large number of people. You know, it's not just Osama bin Laden. It's not just the terrorist masterminds. It's also an enormous number of other people.
Well, is part of the effectiveness of the drones the fact that they people fear them? They strike fear in people. You can't see them way up in the sky. In 1943, the New York Times ran an article with the headline, "Robot Bomb Attacks Here Held probable by Admiral. That must have scared a lot of people.
I think it would. But I think, and I think you're entirely right, I think fear is an important part of the development of any weapon. I would also think that there is a flip side to that, which is that, and again, this is speculation rather than I think that ever could be fully founded, which is that an unmanned weapon might indicate a kind of cowardliness to the opposition, in that it would indicate a reluctance to engage, a reluctance to commit things like ground troops. So it's a kind of warfare that could have very negative PR. And I think that's part of what we're seeing in Afghanistan and Pakistan, where the use of drones has exacerbated in many ways the complexity of those conflicts.
My guest is Daniel Swift, whose article, Conjectural Damage, A History of Bombing, appears in the November issue of Harper's Magazine. Are the people who pilot drones considered combatants under the laws of war?
It's a very interesting question. And the laws of war are, you know, a constantly evolving body of interpretations and understandings. I think that in a strict understanding, yes, you would have to consider the person who is sitting in Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, for example, is one of the big bases for the drone pilots. You would have to consider that person a combatant. But the trouble is there's an enormous crew of people who work on a drone, so it's not simply one person sitting with one computer. There are enormous rotating crews of people, up to perhaps 100 people, to keep a Reaper drone constantly flying, and they work in relays and shifts. So it becomes very unclear exactly who it is that is engaged with the fighting itself.
And I've heard stories of old-time pilots being very upset that these people who sit at these computers in Nevada, what you call the teams of drone warriors who sit at the time of what is legally comprehensible, at the limit of what is legally comprehensible, that they're even considered pilots. They wear flight suits, even though they don't go up in planes.
Yes, and it's actually a fascinating issue, and it's an enormous question which is under the surface of much of the controversy about drones, I think, and about this shifting nature of what a pilot is. Is to do with a change in the conception of what the Air Force is and what it's for. The notion of there being a separate Air Force, i.e. that was not part of the Army, is only one that really follows the Second World War. So arguably, if what we're now seeing is a rise in unmanned planes and a rise in this very remote kind of piloting, perhaps we no longer need a separate Air Force that's defined by flying. Perhaps rather what the drones will give us is a force which relies on planes, certainly, which uses these unmanned planes, but which is subordinate to the Army itself. So there's a much larger shift, I think, in the institutions, military institutions, that accompanies a lot of these conversations about drones.
Is this only happening in this country, or are some of our allies also developing drones?
They're certainly being used everywhere, unfortunately not only by our allies, but also by countries that are perhaps not our allies. You know, everyone, I think, is currently either at work on a drone or will be quite shortly. And many of them, of course, is one of the problems is that once the first generations have been developed, then many other countries can copy those and follow those. So we're seeing a huge spread in the range of countries which have them. Iran, for example, have recently revealed their latest developed unmanned plane.
Why has President Obama made the use of drones one of the key elements of his counterterrorism strategy?
I think there are several answers to that question. I think that they are comparatively very cheap. I think that shouldn't be looked out as a simple reason, but I think an important one. They're also very seductive in many ways, in that, as I was saying before, they appear to promise all sorts of great technological advantages. It's very hard to argue with the attraction of a weapon that appears to avoid something that everyone knows is a nightmare, which is committing large numbers of ground troops. And I would imagine every commander-in-chief wishes to avoid a repetition of any kind of messy land war almost at any cost.
And we don't have pilots being shot down.
Exactly.
Aren't we flying drone attacks over countries that we're not technically at war with, like Yemen and Pakistan? What's the justification for that?
We are indeed. That's also deeply, deeply troubling, in that the drone seems to me to have two separate but allied functions, and one is surveillance and the other one is combat, is bombing attacks. And that it seems very different to me if we are running surveillance over certain countries versus whether we are bombing them. In Libya, for example, there were something like 150 Predator drone strikes. And these weapons do suggest or do seem to permit many more low-level sorts of conflicts to take place at the same time. Again, if these weapons are cheap, which they are comparatively, and if they don't require the commitment of ground troops, then you can run several different campaigns simultaneously, perhaps even campaigns you're not entirely committed to.
But a targeted missile strike with a drone is better than the kind of carpet bombing that we saw in Dresden or in Vietnam.
I think that is true. I mean, I would prefer to avoid all sorts of bombing if possible. But I think that's certainly right, and that's a change in technology. The trouble, and again, I'm slightly repeating myself, but the trouble is the idea behind those two kinds of warfare hasn't changed, which is the idea that a bombing war can be neat and efficient. You know, those who bombed Dresden weren't hoping to absolutely destroy the city. What they were hoping to do was win the war more speedily without committing, without risking large numbers of ground troops. So it's the same idea. That's the real continuity.
Some contend that the use of drones has opened the door to extrajudicial killing, especially as with the case of Anwar al-Awlaki, the U.S.-born cleric who was killed in a drone strike in Yemen last fall.
Yes, I think that is right. And again, that's a very troubling recent rise in the number of targeted extrajudicial killings run by the CIA and by the U.S. Army. It's a story that is very difficult to find much about because these are so classified, but it does seem clear that American military strategy is relying increasingly on these kinds of targeted killings, you know, both committed by drones, but also by small teams of soldiers sent into countries.
And this is the sort of thing that is actually causing us problems with the Pakistani public.
Exactly. I think that's exactly right. And in lots of ways, that's one of the most powerful arguments to clarify exactly what America are doing with these kinds of unmanned weapons. It's because of the PR dimension. That sounds very silly, but it seems that these weapons are causing such a mess in somewhere like Pakistan, which would have potentially been avoidable.
Many people compare drone piloting with playing video games, but you call that a cliched and misleading analogy. What should we compare unmanned aerial vehicles to?
I think it's a good question. My first reaction is I'm a professor of literature, so I'm always interested and worried by analogies being used too weakly. I think there are two reasons why that particular analogy is misleading, which is, firstly, comparing them to a video game suggests that these are something new, where I'm suggesting they've been around for a very long time. And secondly, it suggests that the interesting thing to talk about with drones is the experience of the pilots, the crews in America who are doing the bombing, and it forgets the other side of all bombing, which is to do with the civilians.
The FAA, go ahead.
I was going to say, if I had to choose an analogy, I would compare them to any other kind of manned plane. I think the continuities with the history of manned bombing and unmanned bombing is more interesting than the newness of these unmanned planes.
The FAA is going to release new guidelines on the domestic use of small unarmed drones this January. What are some of the proposed uses for drones within U.S. airspace?
There's a huge range, and this is very funny. I mean, this is a sign of how seductive technology is, which is once you have a piece of new technology, it's very tempting to use it in as many ways as possible. My favorite is the suggestion by the head of FedEx, I think, that, you know, this is the way that FedEx could now deliver their parcels. But there are more serious applications, many of them to do with farming, for example. Farmers could use them to spread pesticide over large areas. And there's also a huge law enforcement application.
The LA Times reported this week that one drone builder, AeroVironment, has been secretly testing a miniature remote-controlled helicopter named Cube. This drone weighs 5.5 pounds, is controlled remotely by a tablet computer, and can take crystal-clear video of what's below it from around 200 feet in the air. Is anyone raising privacy concerns about this kind of technology?
I think people are, and they absolutely should be, because these things can stay overhead taking video for hundreds and hundreds of hours. So that is a real worry. People have begun to have that kind of conversation. But again, this is very recent, and it's interesting to me that until now the FAA have not allowed drones to use American civilian airspace, precisely because they thought they weren't quite precise or accurate enough.
Do the people at Google know about these things?
I would imagine they probably do, and are even now working on a new way of using them.
Well, but this also could be something that we could use in warfare, couldn't we?
Yes, absolutely. All of these have a huge range of applications. Arguably, the civilian use of drones might be a more a more suitable and more effective one. I'm assuming they're going to be used for surveillance rather than, you know, bombing the civilians of America. But and in that sense, that the surveillance could be the absolute kind of perfect application. Very troubling from a George Orwell perspective, but certainly one that could be very useful.
Daniel Swift's article, Conjectural Damage, A History of Bombing, appears in the November issue of Harper's Magazine. And Daniel, thank you so much for being with us today to talk about it.
Thank you for having
me. Slightly scary, but I want my own drone.
Exactly. We all need to have one.